Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning and welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Kai Wright, an editor at The Nation magazine, and I'm sitting in for Brian today and thrilled to kick off 2017 with all of you. As expected, it is off to a tumultuous start, politically at least. But before we even get to that, it's a serious morning here in the city where a subway has derailed in Brooklyn. We're going to WNYC's Stephen Nesson, who is on the ground near Atlantic Terminal. Stephen, hello. Are you with us?
Hey, good morning, Kai.
Good morning. So what happened, Stephen? Catch us up.
Okay. So there's a train from Far Rockaway that was heading into Atlantic Terminal this morning, I believe around 8:30. And apparently it did not stop when it was supposed to at the end of the station. We just had a press conference with the governor and the head of the MTA, Governor Cuomo, Tom Prendergast, and they said that the train was going at a very low speed. Probably they suspect, you know, once they get into the station, they're not going more than 10 or 15 miles an hour, but it is up to the train conductor to fully stop the train when it's supposed to stop. And it appears in this case that for whatever reason, they're still not sure, that didn't happen. And the train ended up hitting what's called the bumping block at the end of the Long Island Railroad stop there. And it hit the bumping block, and it sort of the front car lifted up off its axle. The governor said he's reluctant to call this a derailment because it was just the first car that was lifted off the track, he says. But I was down there, Kai. And you can see when a train gets lifted off the track, it's messy. There's sort of like a service station just behind the bumping block, and the windows there are totally shattered. The door is crumpled, and the train is very much off the track.
Wow. And this is not, I mean, this is a busy station as well. I mean, there were injuries, right? How many people were injured, and what do people need to know about that? Where are they being taken?
They're being taken to different hospitals around this area. I don't know exactly which one, but the official number that I heard now is 37 were injured. None were life-threatening. The worst injury was a woman with a fractured leg. Mm-hmm. So the governor said, you know, we're extremely lucky that, you know, certainly any injury is horrible and should not have occurred. But, you know, compared to other crashes in this area in recent, you know, months and years, Hoboken, of course, the recent crash there is on everybody's mind. This was nowhere close to that. The extent of the damage is limited to track 6, which is sort of the farthest track, you know, the southernmost track on this line. And they say Long Island Railroad will be running this afternoon for the evening commute without delay. So we'll see if that happens.
Okay. Well, but before we get into that, and then so what's going to happen with the service? Who were the injured people? Were these people on the train? Were these people on the platform? Who got hurt?
I don't know exactly which cars they were in, but it was people on the train.
Okay.
And the train was packed. I believe I heard reported there were perhaps 600 people on the train. You know, it was an early morning commute train from Far Rockaway, presumably, you know, packed. It's a busy time of day to commute into Atlantic Terminal.
Right. And so service will be restored this afternoon. What about this morning? Anything riders need to know?
I do not have any update right now.
Okay.
Sorry, Kai.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stephen. We will talk with you later. WNYC will stay on this story all day as it develops. But in the meantime, on to national politics. Yesterday, the new political order in Washington officially arrived. It is true that Donald Trump has to wait another 17 days to become president, but the 115th Congress was sworn in yesterday. And Republicans, of course, won both the House and the Senate in November. They've officially chosen their leadership, and they now claim to the majority control over the people's business. Democrats, meanwhile, are figuring out how to be a party fully in the opposition. So who are these new people? Who are these newly positioned players, really? And what are they planning? What are the potential allegiances? Where are the likely fissures, particularly amongst the Republicans who are now in charge? Here to discuss all of this, the new Congress, Capitol Hill's new political order, is Burgess Everett, the congressional correspondent for Politico. Burgess, welcome.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I am well. And listeners, as always, we want you in on this conversation. Are you a Republican? If so, how do you want the Republican-led Congress to deal with the Trump administration? Do you want them to stay out of the way and support his plans? Or are there particular issues where you want ideological or strategic purity? Are there lines that you do not want congressional Republicans to cross with Trump? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And Democrats, or I guess really anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, do you want congressional Democrats to oppose? Or should they look for points of compromise? And if so, on what? Let us know, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, Burgess, let's start with the politics on the Republican side. Things got off to a raucous start yesterday.
Yeah.
A move to gut the Office of Congressional Ethics was the opening of the act, and it kind of blew up and ended in disaster. Can you sort of tell us what happened here? What went on?
Basically, for weeks, the House Republicans had been sort of planning this, or some of them had been, to push this change. A lot of them felt like this office, had treated them badly and wasn't really beholden to the Congress and would leak things to the media and make them look bad when there was no action by the actual Congressional Ethics Committee, which is run by members of Congress. And so this sort of bubbled up in this day right before the Congress was being sworn in as the Republicans were figuring out their rules package. It was slipped in there, and it passed strongly. The backlash was immediate from the Democrats, from progressives. Trump weighed in. He wasn't critical of the proposal, but of the timing of doing it, saying it sort of reflected bad priorities. They should be concentrating on other things. And so, by midday yesterday, they had removed it, even as they were sort of still defending it just an hour or two before. So it definitely sort of got off to a dysfunctional start of unified Republican control here.
And Trump's tweet, Trump weighing in, seems it was kind of striking to me how it quickly at least appeared to change what was going on for the caucus, that he chimes in and suddenly things change. Or is that how it really went down?
I think it was a factor, but I also think that constituent backlash and people calling offices and things like that was also a factor as well. A lot of these members don't pay attention to what Trump is tweeting, but a lot of them do. So, it kind of depends on how tapped in you are to the Trump administration. But I think that the public backlash was probably the bigger factor than Trump weighing in. But that also probably helped move things along even more quickly.
To build up the public backlash in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. And as we're finding, Trump is tweeting today about Obamacare. It's sort of hard to read exactly what he's saying, but every time he's tweeting about things, the media is becoming quickly distracted by whatever Trump is tweeting and fixating on it.
And is that true in the caucus as well? That's what I can't really wrap my head around. Are members of Congress and Republicans in particular also kind of watching the Twitter feed to see what the administration wants? Or
I cover the Senate primarily, and I would say on my side of the Capitol, they do not. This is generally an older wing of the Congress, mm-hmm. and they're not glued to their phones and checking on what Trump tweets. And the other thing that we've sort of, there's a bit of a trend that we've noticed over the past few months, even during the election, is that, people kind of want to have, be able to say they don't know what's going on Trump's Twitter feed. So, people are often saying, oh, I don't know what's going on that, because they don't necessarily want to be talking about whatever Trump tweeted 30 seconds ago and sort of have to own that.
Yeah. Well, so for the House, for Paul Ryan, he's been elected. He's the official leader. But this was not a promising sign of the leadership's ability to control the caucus. The leadership was largely caught off guard by this, right?
They argued against it. They knew it was coming. I think they were caught off guard by it passing, for sure. They say Ryan and McCarthy, the majority leader, were saying yesterday that they had argued against it and that it passed anyway. And I think this is sort of a reminder that the House, the construction of the House Republican Conference is still pretty unwieldy. There's the Freedom Caucus, and you just have, it's more difficult to get a majority of the majority than you might think on any given day. The House Republicans would remind you that Paul Ryan then won, the speakership pretty strongly, more strongly than he had before. So, you know, it was sort of a mixed bag. You know, there's unity around Paul Ryan, but there's also sort of this, you know, unruliness to the conference where they can kind of go against their leadership, and then it's like, you know, touching a hot stove, they quickly backtracked on the ethics.
And callers, particularly Republicans, if you want to weigh in on this, what you want to see from the new Republican leadership and its relationship to the administration or itself, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And so I also wonder, Burgess, about, you know, Trump's election in and of itself, and before that, really, the, you know, as you point out, the sort of raucousness of the caucus under John Boehner. Both of these things sort of point, if I were a member, I would take the lesson, hey, listen, it's good to be a renegade in this party. The more I buck leadership, the more I do my own thing, the better it'll be for my political fortunes. Is that a reasonable thing?
You know, and I, this going back to what we were talking about before, I think the new factor, though, is if you sort of get at odds with Trump by going against leadership, I think that's where you're seeing a little bit, going to see a little bit more hesitancy. I mean, you're totally correct, especially the Freedom Caucus. A lot of these members sort of understood that, you know, if you're in opposition to the quote-unquote establishment, you're going to get headlines, and even if your strategy doesn't end up working, you sort of have this new sphere of influence. But now that Republicans sort of control everything in Washington once Trump takes over on January 20th, it becomes a little different. It's less about disrupting a divided government or pushing, being oppositional. You know, these guys are going to run the government, and they're going to start to own every failure and not be able to blame it on President Obama, which, you know, you're still seeing, you know, as his presidency winds down. And after January 20th, that's really not going to work anymore. So I do think that they're going to have to be a little bit more careful and more unified if they want to get anything done, because really there's a fairly short window before, you know, politics start seeping in, especially on the Senate side ahead of these midterm elections. And we're talking about maybe, you know, 9 to 10 months, maybe even fewer months of actual time to sort of seize on this momentum from the election. And so they need to be careful not to derail things early, or else it's going to be difficult for them to get the things done that they are saying they want to do, like tax reform and replacing Obamacare.
Yeah, it's funny to think about how quickly we move to the next election from this
one.
Yeah,
and on the House side, you know, the Senate map is bad for Democrats. You know, they're going to be trying to sort of stop their losses. There's really no way for them to take back the Senate. But in the House, Democrats are probably going to start talking a big game and saying they think there might be a Trump backlash and we can take back the House. So, yeah, I do think these things are going to, you know, come out, you know, within 9 months by the end of the summer, and we're going to be sort of starting to talk about how every vote affects the midterm election.
Let's go to Ernest in the Bronx. Ernest, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year.
Well, I'm a Democrat, but the Democrats are cowards. And the reason why I say that is because when they had an opportunity to run on our president's record, they would have won. But because Republicans did nothing for an entire 8 years, they did absolutely nothing. And now they're going to come in and make believe that they're going to do all this grandeur things, and it's going to hurt worse than they're going to help, because they're going to try to get rid of everything. They already started ethics. Come on, man. You want to start with the ethics of all things? That gives you an idea of what these guys are planning on doing. The ETA, all of it. Education, all of it. So we're going to have a rough road to travel. But the Democrats had an opportunity to run on this president's record of saving the financials, saving the banks, saving the housing, getting 20 million people health care, people who don't even know they got Obamacare. When you ask them, do you have health care? How's your health care? Oh, it's good. Do you like Obamacare? Oh, no. But they're already on Obamacare and don't know it. So the Democrats did a terrible job in doing what they were supposed to do when they were running for office, and not having the president come out and campaign for him or run on his record.
Ernest, do you think that, you know, I think the Republicans would argue they now have a mandate. Do you feel like they've got a mandate based on this election to do all of the things that you fear they're going to do?
Well, I don't think they have a mandate, because we need regulations. We need We need water. We need air. Don't go taking regulations off of things that's working. But we have so many billionaires in this cabinet right now. And people, come on, you're not going to tell me a billionaire cares about or cares about the small guy down here. He cares about that his pocketbook, and that's all. And that's all they're going to care about when they start to turn this whole country upside down.
All right. Well, thanks, Ernest. Burgess, the Democrats, he says, are cowards. The Democrats also are back in town. Of course, Chuck Schumer is now the leader. You have written about what his leadership style will be. It's going to be very different from Harry Reid, as I gather. Tell us about that difference. What's going to be different about Chuck Schumer?
I mean, it's more of this sort of, and part of it is that his protecting of these 10 Democrats who are up for re-election in 2018 in states that Trump won. So he sort of has to cater to the moderate wing of the party in a way that Harry Reid was, you know, didn't necessarily see as a key priority, and that manifested itself most in Joe Manchin, who's probably the most conservative Democrat from West Virginia, who, you know, was criticizing Harry Reid while he was going out the door, and Harry Reid was just really not having it and didn't really want to talk about Manchin and sort of made it clear that, you know, he thought that Manchin was sort of out of step with the party. So I think, you know, it's a tough spot for Schumer because, like we just heard from that caller, Ernest, you know, the Democratic base wants the party to fight Trump and the Republicans at every turn. But then Schumer has to deal with these people who are running for re-election, five of them in states that Trump won overwhelmingly. So how do you balance that? I mean, one thing they do is you have 60 votes to do any legislation in the Senate besides a couple of these reconciliation opportunities, which we can get to later, but that's at a majority threshold. So with that 60-vote threshold, you can lose some of these moderate Democrats and still block stuff. Then the other thing that the Democrats are trying to figure out is how hard to take it to Trump's cabinet. They can't block any of these nominees that have to be confirmed, but they are sort of saying, you know, this is our beginning of our political comeback. Let's make these nominees look out of step with Trump's electorate, that he's not draining the swamp, that these are billionaires who are going to be against the working class's interests. And so they want to drag these out and turn each of these into like a couple-day fight that draws a lot of media attention. You know, that's going to require a lot of cooperation among the Democrats and some resolve because, you know, these nominees are mostly going to be confirmed, whether Democrats like it or not. And so, you know, even though they're not going to get the end result of blocking them, you know, can they stick together and make it as painful as possible for the Republicans?
Just cause as much chaos as possible in the process. And Republicans have threatened, though, that they'll also go to the mat on these nominations, that they're going to keep the Senate open round the clock and make opposition as painful as possible, right?
Yeah, and that's correct. And, you know, this being the Senate, lots of 60, 70-year-old, 80-year-old people, you know, I think we may get to that point where we do have one or two or three overnight sessions and all these crazy votes at ridiculous times and things like that. But I wouldn't expect that to go on for too long. This happened about 4 years ago when the rules change happened, which lets cabinet nominees be confirmed by a simple majority, and it just happened for two nights. So it's really kind of an untenable way to do business. But I do expect there to be a lot of fireworks on the floor right after Inauguration Day when Republicans try to confirm Trump's cabinet quickly and Democrats probably object.
Let's go to Richard in Manhattan. Richard, welcome to WNYC.
Yes. I think that what we have to do is we have to be a bit less disdainful about, first of all, how Trump communicates through Twitter. Every time I hear it mentioned, I always feel that the speaker is basically looking down a bit on this mode of communication. There isn't anything constitutional that prohibits, you know, non-classified matters from being shared with the general public. I think it's a transparent form of government. And I also think that both sides of the House have to realize it's not a partisan issue. It isn't a Democratic or Republican issue, first of all, how Trump communicates. Secondly, I feel that he's trying to be somewhat of a centrist. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and for the first time in my life, I voted Republican when my candidate, Bernie Sanders, got crowded out. So I feel he's trying to be more of a centrist here and put the gutting of the ethics bill on the back burner as kind of a conciliatory measure, yes. But by doing so, I think he's trying to work both sides of the aisle.
Richard, can I ask you, you said your candidate was Bernie Sanders, and then you moved to Trump when he got crowded out. So looking at the cabinet appointments that Trump has made thus, that are, the, you know, his nominations, his expected nominations, these do not look like the kind of people that Bernie Sanders would be nominating. Help me understand how do you go from one to the other? I actually don't understand the comparison between the two.
Well, for one thing, the cabinet he's assembling is obviously a pro-business candidacy. Then you also have to consider that the one drawback to Bernie Sanders' education plan, which I wholeheartedly supported, was the fact that Bernie Sanders couldn't make the financial business case for how it could be implemented. So I feel that in the Trump presidency, what you're going to have is you're going to have a more positive economic picture over the next 4 years. And in so doing, I don't see any reason why Trump won't get behind the concept of free education and secondary school the way Cuomo has just succeeded in doing in New York State, which is a laudable effort. I see Trump coming more to the center on the education issue, and the cabinet he's appointing, I feel, it just has to guarantee, you know, a better P&L, if you will, for the country.
Mm. And Bernie Sanders is going to no doubt be in full-throated opposition, he has said, to most things that Trump is going to do. If you were supporting him, do you want to see that from Bernie Sanders?
I actually would have liked very much to see Trump cross aisles and offer Bernie Sanders the position of education secretary, because it's obvious that Senator Sanders has given the most thought to the fact that education is the great equalizer of the people. And the best way to reduce any kind of racial disparity or cultural disparity and feelings of prejudice is to make sure everybody has the opportunity to get a stellar education. Once that happens, then issues like Social Security and welfare become slightly less important in that the next generation is better educated and may not need these social services. So I see Bernie Sanders objecting to the cabinet picks, but I hope Bernie Sanders realizes that there has to be a good economic base for the federal government to be able to offer free secondary education.
Thanks, Richard. Burgess, so I think Bernie Sanders is, at least by his own statement, on quite a different page than Richard about the Trump administration. And and you mentioned, you know, Schumer's leadership style has been to bring it to deal with these centrist Democrats who are going to have to face reelection, try to bring them into the big tent. But he's also in his 10 senators that he's brought into leadership, he's also brought in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the left of the party, which is quite insurgent. Do you see what kind of influence do you see them having on Schumer and having on this caucus?
I think on tactics, especially right now on these confirmations, you know, the left is sort of winning out on, you know, this oppositional stance towards Trump's cabinet. People like Jeff Sessions for the Attorney General, or Betsy DeVos to be the Education Secretary, or Steven Mnuchin to be the Treasury Secretary. You know, these are all people that progressives are sort of waging this war against right now. And for the most part, you know, Schumer's adopted that. You know, I think things will change once we get into the legislating phase of the new Congress in a couple months. Where, you know, Democrats are going to be sort of the deal breaker on a lot of these things in Washington, because this is really the only place in the Senate where Democrats can stop things. And so that's sort of where the balance of the party is going to come into play. And, you know, these next 2 years are going to be unique because these senators, these five moderates, you know, that's really the entire moderate wing of the Senate Democrats. So once you get past that election, you know, the party probably swings back a bit to the left on the Senate side in terms of its priorities. But there's, you know, big fear. You know, Republicans have 52 seats now in the Senate, and, you know, it's improbable but possible that Republicans could get 60 votes in 2018 if Trump is popular and Democrats are unpopular. You know, that's a long way away. But, you know, every step leaders like Schumer make is sort of looking towards preventing that. If Trump were to end up with a filibuster-proof majority, you could really see a huge erosion of everything that President Barack Obama did.
So, well, we're talking a lot about what Chuck Schumer wants to do and how he's going to deal with being in opposition. And he spoke to this himself yesterday. And I think we have tape we can play of the new Democratic leader describing his own perspective on being in opposition.
There are those who suggest that our baseline posture should be to work with the president-elect and have him pass his whole agenda. But, Mr. President, it is not our job to be a rubber stamp. It's our job to do what's best for the American people, the middle class, and those struggling to get there. If the president-elect proposes legislation that on issues like infrastructure and trade and closing the carried interest loophole, for instance, will work in good faith to perfect and potentially enact it. But when he doesn't, we will resist.
So he, at least in that part of his speech, is talking about significant resistance. Let's go to Richard in Staten Island.
Yes, hi. I hope that they don't concede on anything. My view of Donald Trump is that he's not just a Republican, that we survive Republicans and Democrats all the time. This man is a fascist, and you don't cooperate with fascists, even if he says things like, oh, I'm going to employ 10,000 people. Well, that's great. And my old statement is Mussolini, made the trains run on time. But there's a lot more important things. The Democratic Party should be an opposition party, and we should stand against fascism. This, again, is not the old niceties of Republicans and Democrats, working together, some a little more conservative, some a little more liberal. I think this is a whole new ballgame. And the Democrats, if they sit on their hands or they just worry about the next election, the country's going to, hell in a handbasket. It's just, I think it's a terrible situation, and I think we should resist.
Thanks, Richard. So those are big words that he's using, Burgess. And there were members of Congress and people in both parties who were saying those kinds of things, certainly in the lead up to the vote last year. What is the mood just on the whether or not we're in a totally different new era with the Trump administration on the Hill right now? Are people still saying those kinds of things, or are they in a well, let's go kind of space?
When you look at how Republicans treated President Barack Obama and sort of, this blockade of resistance to pretty much everything he did, a lot of party line votes, even when President Obama had the supermajority in the Senate in those first 2 years and was able to pass things like Obamacare and Dodd-Frank financial reform and the stimulus package, ever since then, everything has been a slug. And, rather than a public backlash to that, Republicans have gradually taken back the House and then the Senate and then a bunch of state legislatures and a bunch of governorships. So, you can definitely argue with the tactics, but for Republicans, it's hard to argue with the results. So if you're a Democrat, especially a liberal Democrat who just watched this happen, you may be starting to say to yourself, why don't we do the same thing? Why don't we make the if Republicans are in complete control of the government, if we can make things sort of grind to a halt and make them look ineffective, they're the ones that are going to be punished. And so I do think that the tactics of Congress and obstruction and things like that we are in this sort of new era, probably from the midway point of the George W. Bush presidency up till now, where everything has been escalated. The Supreme Court nominee that comes through is going to be a major fight. You could see it blocked, then you could see another rules change. I do think we're in sort of this, ammunition stockpiling phase where each party is trying to one-up the other one in terms of this strategy. And I don't know where it ends, but I do think that last caller, was channeling a significant portion of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. We're going to go to Jim in Millington, New Jersey, who I think has something to say about this idea of the Republicans' mandate that I brought up earlier.
That's right. Thanks for taking my call. How are you this morning?
I'm well. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, I keep hearing the word mandate. He took 26% of registered voters, not the population, but the registered voters, 26% of them. 40,000 votes in four different states would have thrown the election the other direction. They didn't take the House and the Senate. They kept them. They lost a couple seats. There's really no mandate here whatsoever, and I'm kind of tired of people talking about it. And he's governing as though he's got a mandate. He's put an old-school Southern racist at the Justice Department, a woman in charge of the Education Department that's openly hostile to public education. This is not what he was mandated to do.
Well, thank you, Jim. Bridges, once again, as you can hear, as you've said, folks, at least on the Democratic side, are not ready for anything that looks like compromise. What's going to happen first? We know already that that Obamacare is right out of the gate. I believe that the Republicans have started the repeal process today, actually, correct, in the Senate?
There's going to be a vote in the Senate on a budget resolution, which is basically meaningless except for the fact that later they can go back and use that to repeal Obamacare in a few weeks by a bare majority. And so that's what we're looking at right now. But, I mean, really beyond that, we have no clue. We don't know, you know, they're going to do this thing called a repeal and delay. But we don't know how long the delay is going to be. You know, they're going to repeal the law and it'll go into effect between 1 and 3 years, maybe longer, maybe shorter. You know, we don't know. There's a lot of disparate ideas out there right now. And then beyond that, you have to get into the replacement plan, and they don't have one yet. And they're going to need Democrats to pass it in the Senate, which goes back to those dynamics we were talking about earlier with all the moderates up for re-election. So there's really a lot of uncertainty here about where things go legislatively. But, you know, a lot of the first month is going to be about cabinet nominees, confirmations, and fights over them.
And on Obamacare, Schumer has said that they are not going to participate in trying to rewrite it. I think they've unveiled the slogan, Make America Sick Again. Is that correct, how they're going
to... That's true, but I've also talked to other members of the caucus who don't necessarily agree with that. You know, it's really, you know, the Republicans believe, perhaps rightfully, you know, we'll see, that Democrats would be blamed for sitting on the sidelines and not helping replace the law. You know, I think what Schumer is mostly saying is that don't help them write the replacement. Let them bring a replacement out, then we'll see what happens.
Well, we will leave it there. Burgess Everett, congressional correspondent for Politico. Thanks for joining us, Burgess.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
And coming up next, 2016 brought us a host of unwelcome surprises. Could 2017 top last year's follies? We'll discuss. Stay tuned.